Well, good evening once again. This is John St. Germain bringing you the Crystal Silence League Hour. And this is, of course, Tuesday, November 17th, 2015. And once again, we're going to take a look at Buddhism 101, Enlighten Me. We're looking at the factors of enlightenment, the steps going into Buddhism. And please, if you have any questions, of course, you can call them in. Our guest call-in number is 657-383-0525. Always, as usual, press 1, and a little light will come up and say, boom. And when that comes up, we'll, of course, look at you and raise your hand. This is, of course, the Crystal Silence League, so have your crystal balls handy. And please, some people are not getting any sound. Please let me know in chat if you're having trouble with sound, and we'll attempt to fix that. Some people do have trouble with that, but let me know immediately if you're in chat, if you're in our studio audience and you're having no sound. Please let me know immediately, and we'll see if we can remedy that. Okay, some people are having trouble and some are not, so that's apparently a blog talk radio glick with some people. Just let me know how the sound quality is going, and we'll see if we can remedy that. But we will be back after a short musical interlude, so do please join us. With your crystal balls in hand, or next to you. And we're back. And I hope you enjoyed our musical interlude. If you enjoyed it, that, of course, is an arrangement by David Lons, Whiter Shade of Pale. If you didn't enjoy it, blame me, because that's me playing the piano. It's my fault if you didn't enjoy it. Our crystal tonight is orange kyanite, and I do love kyanite. We've discussed kyanite before, and kyanite comes in literally every color in the spectrum. It goes everywhere from clear all the way up to purple, and therefore you can make a collection of kyanite for every chakra that you want to treat. And orange kyanite is wonderful. We've been talking a lot about the orange, amber, yellow, orange crystals in that range, and it's commensurate with our topic. It is copacetic with our topic I'm throwing weird crystals and weird words at you this week. But orange kyanite is a happy crystal, and it helps with the imagination. It helps with people who are dealing with creative blockages, and it helps you to be more confident with your creativity, with your out-of-the-box thinking, and it helps you be a little bit more immune to self-criticism and also the criticism of others. It helps you disengage the critical facility, and it helps you disengage the critical facility and allow the lyrical to come through. It helps bring back that childlike sense of wonderment necessary for creative thinking. It can also be very good, and I've used this a lot with my clients, helping with issues involving addiction, food eating disorders, alcohol addictions, things like that. It can help you with problems, blockages of the libido, sexual dysfunction. So our orange kyanite is very useful for these things. If you know about chakras and stuff, you know that orange works with the sacral chakra. So a very useful thing. The Crystal Silence League, our folks, in case you're thinking we're the NFL Discussion League or Worldwide Wrestling Discussion League, that's the other channel. We are the Crystal Silence League. And, of course, the Crystal Silence League was founded around 1917 by Claude Alexander Conlon for the purpose of distributing positive prayer and affirmation for those in need of such. And when he passed into the silence around 1958, I believe, the Crystal Silence League went with him. And when he passed through, the Crystal Silence League went into the silence with him. And then it was founded again in a few years ago by adepts of the Missionary Independent Spiritual Church in cybernetic form. And prayer is always free. You can go to www.crystalsilenceleague.org and post your prayers. And it's our custom, since we founded the show about a year ago now, that we read these prayers out loud. You can also go to our website and subscribe to our newsletter. Our archives are up to date as of October. We have all the newsletters archived as of October, so we're up to date. And I am now going to read aloud some prayers. They are anonymous. I only identify them by prayer ID. And please join me in prayer. And if you have your crystal balls, project your thoughts into the crystal balls as well. So we're going to start with prayer ID number 44220, who prays that her lover join her on her birthday. This is apparently an estranged lover, and she prays that her birthday is coming up and that her lover join her. Then we have prayer ID number 44219, another estranged lover, and she prays that her estranged lover sees that the relationship needs to be reforged. And prayer ID number 44218, also a prayer for another estranged couple. This person is praying that a couple that she knows have a reconciliation. The couple's initials are R and M, and hope that they become that they reforge their marital bond. Now, we have prayer ID number 44217, who prays that God puts a hedge of protection around someone whose initials are T. Prayer ID number 44216, AT prays that he or she is unemployed and desperately needs a job immediately. You know, may this person find a job immediately to help pay his or her bills. Prayer ID number 44215, AP needs to sell their house. They're struggling to sell their house, and they need to get it done. They have some showings, but nothing, no real interest, so may that happen. Prayer ID number 44214 needs some money owed to him or her released so that they get this money. They desperately need it. Prayer ID number 44213, MS, prays for a healthy pregnancy. Prayer ID number 44212, ST, in desperate need of a part-time job, actively searching for it, needs to have it. Apparently, she has initiated a steady work spell kit last Sunday and is looking for work every day. I believe that spell kit may work for you. That's a very good kit. A Lucky Mojo steady work kit, I assume, and that's good stuff. Prayer ID number 44211, NFT, prays to have her husband return to her. Prayer ID number 44210, NFT, also prays for reconciliation. Prayer and to stop divorce proceedings. Prayer ID number 44209, RC, prays that T comes home and stays home. Prayer ID number 44208, KW, says she's doing her best and hopes that her job has a steady increase, increase in pay, and that her boss seizes her micromanaging. Man, I can relate to that back when I worked. Prayer ID number 44207, DB, prays for a successful outcome of her work. Apparently she's doing some spell work, and that B will follow his heart and come back to her. she's doing some mojo work. Prayer ID number 44206, NG, prays that her bad luck and love be removed and lifted. May that happen. I sure hope that does happen. Prayer ID number 44205 also prays for a reconciliation in her love life. And prayer ID number 44204, TM, wishes that there be peace with us all today and every day. May we trust God to be exactly who we are and where we're meant to be. And may we not forget the infinite possibilities that are born of trusting God. Prayer ID number 44203, DP, prays for steady work so he can support his family. And prayer ID number 44202, TM, needs immediate financial help. And finally, prayer ID number 44201, CP, please pray for his intention. There is a friend who is age 64 who's suffering from stage 4 colon cancer, going through chemotherapy. And he prays that the medicine works for him, and he surrenders his will to the highest powers to recover from this, and for his mother to recover from her breathing problems. And he begs to enlighten the minds of those who have hired him for his job, and to issue the visa during the week. So he's got a lot of things going, and may he be helped through all these ordeals. Let us take just a moment of silence for these people, for all who have posted on the Crystal Silence League, and for all who need prayer and comfort. Amen, and so may it be. Well, we're back, and our topic this week, of course, We're continuing our examination of Buddhism. I'd like to take a moment to talk about New Thought and how Buddhism was entangled and incorporated. And it does seem that we're having a little connection issues with Blog Talk Radio tonight. This could be bandwidth, or it could just be some of the general demonic curses that afflict Blog Talk. Blog Talk Radio seems to be having some issues tonight. Some people in our studio audience seem to be having trouble logging in. I hope this is not epidemic or endemic or pandemic even with the rest of the people. But they seem to be switching browsers and fiddling with their settings, and our studio audience seems to be fixing these problems. So, you know, may it be fixed soon. We're working on that and sending out projections and positive prayer to attempt to fix these problems, as well as apparently some people are contacting tech support at Blog Talk Radio. I believe prayer is going to be more effective than that, though, with past experience being what it has been. So let's talk a little bit about New Thought. New Thought had a belief, which I have learned to rely on, that there is a universal consciousness, a divine mind, and this divine mind consists of a network of every thought, every consciousness that has ever lived, and possibly which ever will live. And this corresponds with a implication in Buddhism that consciousness is a quality of the universe, something that is inherent in the universe, a quality that's just built in, like mass and matter and gravity. And Buddha never came out and said this sort of thing because he never talked about how the universe was made. Well, he sort of did now and again. He implied it, but he did say that consciousness was something that has been here since beginning it, been here since beginning was time, and that nobody can remember the beginning of consciousness. So there's that. So what we see with this is that consciousness is the quality of awareness. Consciousness is that which is aware, that which cognizes. So what we learn from this is that there is something in the universe that is aware. Divine mind, as it was seen in New Thought, was the sum total of all awarenesses. Now, the idea of this is when you think about it, is immense and unfathomable. There's no way we can get our mind around this. And last week we discussed the Vedic concept of elements, how fire was everywhere, how fire is imminent, it's everywhere, how earth, air, liquid was everywhere in everything. And these are the components of existence. And it's very important to understand that these concepts were not meant to explain reality, but to understand existence. These were not Western scientific concepts meant to be physics. This was not to explain physical reality, but to explain, but to understand existence. So when the Buddha was talking about the mind like fire, unbound, he was talking to an audience that already understood the Vedic concept of fire being everywhere, imminent. He was comparing consciousness to fire. It was everywhere, imminent. And when fire was kindled, it became concentrated in one spot, just as you and I are. So understand that in New Thought, there is in the divine mind a perfect me, a perfect you, that is everywhere. Imagine the template of John, you know, of Catherine, of Becky, of Sue, of John, of Jimmy, Roger. That is a perfect consciousness, a perfect template of us, of you, of me, that exists in the divine consciousness. And if we can connect to that, then we can be that perfect us. Now, that's a very difficult thing to do, and probably we'll never achieve that perfection, but we can get closer and closer to it. And that is very good. If we did achieve that perfection, we would become a Bodhi mind, a Buddha mind. And these are the overlapping concepts, just in different languages. We can achieve that perfection that is already there. This is why some forms of Buddha say that we're already Buddhas. You know, we're already Buddhas. We just have to get out of our own way and be what we already are. You understand that there are different approaches, different angles to this. So there are many different Vedic texts that contain all kinds of different models and theories about the physics of fire, but they all have one point in common. Fire, even when it's not manifest, continues to exist in latent form. So our perfect selves, the same way, even when we're not manifesting our own perfection, it does exist in a latent form. I'm going to pause for a minute so that sinks in. Even when our perfection doesn't exist in manifest form, it still continues to exist in a latent form. So the Vedic view, which the Buddha used as a model for a lot of his teachings, is that all physical phenomena are manifestations of pre-existent potencies inherent in nature. And every type of phenomenon has its corresponding potency, which has both personal and impersonal characteristics. And in Vedic thought, there's both a God and the phenomenon the God represents, which the Vedics called Agni, A-G-N-I, Agni. Now, Agni, if in terms of fire, oh, there's a lot about that. Agni, in one sense, in Agni's embryonic form, there's a theory of generation that was held in ancient India. In the laws of Manu, there's a verse: the husband, after having entered his wife, becomes an embryo and is born again of her. That was one idea of Agni, the life force. Agni is the life force. There's another version of Agni. In the Upanishads, to you, immortal, when you spring to life, all the gods sing for joy. By your powers they were made immortal. Agni, who extended himself over all the worlds, is the protector of immortality. But not only immortal, Agni is omnipresent. In his manifest form, present in all three levels of the cosmos, heaven, air, and earth, as sun, lightning, and flame fire. And for his latent presence, he states in the myth of his hiding, my body's entered various places. And a survey of the Vedas reveal a wide variety of places where his embryos may be found. Some of them, such as stone, wood, plants, and kindling sticks, relate directly to the means by which fire is kindled and fueled. So Agni, the life force, the spirit, is the potential for generation, for procreation, for creativity, for life. Agni is found in water, plants, animals, and all beings. And the final bottom line, Agni fills the entire universe as the latent embryo of growth and vitality. And many of the scholars of Vedic thought believe that Agni is one of the most comprehensive symbols of the reality that is all-encompassing. And once again, we're talking about universal consciousness, the God mind, the Bodhi mind, the divine mind, the universal mind. Agni pervades the heaven and earth. His forms are scattered everywhere. In plants and herbs and all existent beings, I, Agni, have deposited the embryo of increase. I have engendered all progeny on earth and sons and women hereafter. There are millions of verses like this in the Vedas. If you leaf through them, you find them everywhere. You, Ongi, have filled earth, heaven, and the air between, and follow the whole cosmos like a shadow. This view of Ongi as a latent state is immortal and omnipresent. It occurs in the Upanishads. It occurs everywhere, all through the Vedic canon. Now, I'm going on and on and on about this because it's really important to understand why the Buddha used the enlightened mind and used the fire analogy. This is not like Western concept of fire. And if you want to really see why this is important, all you have to do is get on any Buddhist forum and see the millions of pages of bandwidth wasted in the debate about whether Buddha really understood the modern physics of fire, if Buddha knew about adenosine triphosphate and molecules and how fire and carbon-based chemistry worked, or if he believed in the Vedic theory of fire, and if so, was he really omniscient, etc. And I just keep thinking when the Buddha returns in the form of Maitreya, the laughing Buddha, and somebody is going to ask him, so really, did Gautama Buddha believe the Vedic theory of all-encompassing flame, or was he aware of the modern physics? And the laughing Buddha is going to laugh and say, leave me out of it. Maitreya is going to say, leave me out of it. Man, I'm trying to teach people enlightenment. I don't care about that crap. So it's very important to understand that he was using analogies that his audience understood. This was prevalent thinking. He was using a model that was understood by his audience to teach them what the mind unbound was like. So we look back Kathmandu, as the one fire has entered the world and become corresponding to form in every form, so the inner soul of all things corresponds in form to every form and yet is outside. As the material form of fire, when latent in its source, is not perceived and yet in its subtle form is not destroyed, but may be seized again in its fuel source, so truly both the universal Brahma and the individual soul are to be seized in the body by means of the meditation word Aum, making one's body the lower friction stick, and Aum, the upper stick. Practicing the drill of meditative absorption, one may see the God hidden, as it were. This is not Buddhist text. This is Vedic text. So, this is what was known. This is what was known about the time of the Buddha. A lot of these texts were being composed. Before Buddha, they were being composed, but also around Buddha's lifetime, they were being composed. As fire through the loss of fuel grows still, extinguished in its own source, so thought by loss of activities grows still in its own source. For by tranquility of thought, one destroys good and evil karma. With tranquil soul, stayed on the soul, one enjoys unending ease. Now this begins to sound a lot like the teachings of Buddha. So this reevaluation of the image of fire, seeing its extinguishing as preferable to its burning, it predated the founding of Buddhism, was influenced by it, or maybe it paralleled it. No one can say for sure, as there are no firm dates for any of the Upanishads. But at any rate, in both stages of the Vedic attitude toward fire, the thought of a fire going out carried no connotations of going out of existence or extinguishment at all. And this is a major misunderstanding about modern Buddhism. You'll see it a lot. This is why the whole idea of nirvana meant extinguishment to a lot of people for a long time. Instead, it implied a return to an omnipresent, immortal state. And this has led some scholars, many scholars, to assume that in using the image of an extinguished fire to illustrate the goal he taught, the Buddha was simply adopting the Vedic position wholesale and meant to carry it the same implications as the previous ideas in Vedic thought, a pleasant eternal existence for a tranquil soul. But that's not quite the whole story either. I used to get these long discussions with bhikkhus about this, trying to pin it down, and it's very hard to pin down, very hard to pin down. When you look at how the Buddha actually used the image of extinguished fire in his teachings, he approached the Vedic idea of latent fire from another angle altogether. And that's what, why Buddha was such an incredible person. He approaches the whole thing from a psychological angle, not a mystical angle. How does it affect consciousness? How does it affect the mind? If latent fire is everywhere all at once, it's nowhere in particular, right? If it's conceived as always present in everything, it has to be so loosely defined that it has no defining characteristics, nothing by which it might be known at all. It's like trying to quantify vacuum. Thus, instead of using the substance of latent fire as an image for immortality, he uses the diffuse, indeterminate nature of extinguished fire, as understood by the Vedists, to illustrate the absolute indescribability of the person who has reached the Buddhist goal. Just as the destruction of a glowing fire struck with a blacksmith's iron hammer, gradually growing calm, isn't known. Even so, there's no destination to describe for those who are rightly released, having crossed over the flood of sensuality's bonds, for those who've attained unwavering ease. So, once again, we've got to go back to the Vajragada Sutta, where the wandering salesman, he's a peddler, a traveling salesman. That's what Vacha was, a traveling salesman, a wandering peddler, a traveling salesman. But Venerable Gautama, the monk whose mind is released, where does he reappear? Reappear, Vacha doesn't apply. In that case, Venerable Gautama, he does not reappear. Does not reappear, Vacha doesn't apply. Both does not reappear, doesn't apply. Neither does nor does not reappear, doesn't apply. At this point, Venerable Gautama, I'm befuddled, at this point confused. The modicum of clarity coming to me from your earlier conversation is now obscured. Of course you're befuddled, Vacha. Of course you're confused. Deep, Vacha, is this phenomenon, hard to see, hard to realize, tranquil, refined, beyond the scope of conjecture, subtle, to be experienced by the wise. For those with other views, other practices, other satisfactions, other aims, other teachers, it is difficult to know. That being the case, I will now put some questions to you. This was Buddha's technique. He'd ask questions until you arrived at an answer. Answer as you see fit. How do you construe this, Vacha? If a fire were burning in front of you, would you know that this fire is burning in front of me? Yes. And suppose someone were to ask you, Vacha, this fire burning in front of you, dependent on what is it burning? Thus asked, how would you reply? I would reply, this fire burning in front of me is burning dependent on grass and timber as its sustenance. If the fire burning in front of you were to go out, would you know that this fire burning in front of me has gone out? Yes. And suppose someone were to ask you, this fire that has gone out in front of you, in which direction from here has it gone? East, west, north, or south? Thus asked, how would you reply? That doesn't apply, Venerable Gautama. Any fire burning dependent on a substance of grass and timber being unnourished from having consumed that sustenance and not being offered any other is classified simply as out. Even so, Vacha, any form by which one describing the Tathagata, remember the Tathagata is called the thus gone one, or the thus come one, depending on how you look at it, would describe him that the Tathagata has abandoned its root substance, destroyed, made like a palmyra stump, deprived of the conditions of existence, not destined for future arising, freed from the classification of form. Vacha, the Tathagata is deep, boundless, hard to fathom like the sea. Reappears, doesn't apply. Does not reappear, doesn't apply. Both does and does not reappear, doesn't apply. Neither reappears nor does not reappear, doesn't apply. And he goes down the whole list of elements. Any feeling, perception, fabrication, none of those apply. Any consciousness by which one describing the Tathagata would describe him that the Tathagata has abandoned, freed from the classifications of consciousness, Vacha, the Tathagata is deep, boundless, hard to fathom like the sea. Now, understanding the simile of fire as understood by the Vedists, this becomes very clear. It becomes very clear, or at least becomes clearer. it becomes at least a little more clear. And at this point, let's stop for some station identification and maybe a cool drink, and we will digest a little bit of that.
You are listening to the LMC Radio Network, whose art and information may be found on its webcast shows. The LMC Radio Network is a community radio alliance of metaphysical, spiritual, inspirational, and political justice broadcasters spanning a wide range of topics. Tune in Sundays for the Lucky Mojo Hoodoo Rootwork Hour, hosted by Catherine Ironwood and Conjurman Ali. It features panel discussions on traditional African-American hoodoo spellcasting with members of the Association of Independent Readers and Rootworkers, plus free readings and magical rootwork advice for live call-in clients. The longest-running conjure show in the universe, it may be heard from 3 o'clock to 4:30 Pacific Time, Sunday afternoons. On Mondays, get ready for Candelo's Corner, starring Candelo Cambisa. This is the meeting place for all esoteric traditions. Candelo brings his insight as a Polero and eclectic spiritualist to his interviews with peers in Afro-Caribbean lineages, as well as representatives of numerous other spiritualities and religions. You can hear Candelo's Corner Monday evenings from 5 to 7 Pacific Time. Tuesdays feature two wonderful shows to suit your taste. On the Crystal Silence League Hour, John St. Germain provides spiritual guidance and tips on the practical use of crystals and crystal balls. His show starts at 5 p.m. Pacific Time and lasts for 1 hour. Next is In the Streets with Beverly Smith. Beverly provides up-to-the-minute reports on civil and social rights issues. Her one-hour show airs on Tuesday evenings at 6 p.m. Pacific Time. On Wednesday nights, Kai Arman broadcasts On Sacred Ground, a tapestry of our times comprising history, ethnography, and shamanism, featuring the voices of the land and the deceased, aided by scholars, spirit workers, and environmentalists. Kai's show airs from 5 to 7 Pacific Time. On Thursdays, it's the Now You Know Show with Professor Porterfield. In a variety show laced with country wit and biblical wisdom, the professor shares his knowledge of roots, delivers the lucky numbers, and explores the secrets of scriptural sorcery. From 6 to 7:30 p.m. Pacific Time, there's no end to the surprises. And on Saturday nights, come out and join Liquid Libations. Andrea Weston hosts this informal sharing and showcasing of poetry, short stories, and spoken word performances contributed by novices and professional wordsmiths. Call in and read your work. Liquid Libations may be heard on Saturday nights from 5 to 7 p.m. Pacific Time. All shows on the LMC Radio Network are sponsored by the Lucky Mojo Curio Company, located in Forestville, California, and online at luckymojo.com. Add 3 hours for Eastern, tax and license may apply, train departure times and Burma shave signs subject to change without notice. LMC.
And we're back discussing, believe it or not, this is Buddhism 101. There are concepts in a branch of Buddhism called the Abhidharma. Advanced Buddhist psychology that translates as Abhidharma, advanced Dharma, which which would blow your mind. But I'm so happy to be discussing what we're discussing. I get tingly. I mean, I really do. I get tingly and happy to share these things. Whenever I try to talk about these one-on-one with many people, they interrupt me and say, so what does Buddhism say about the purpose of man in the universe? And what does Buddhism say about why the universe is here and how the universe came into being? And what does Buddhism say about the ultimate fate of man? And these are the very questions that Buddha avoided. In fact, there is a wonderful sutta where a monk came up to him and asked those very questions. The monk was sitting around thinking, said, hey, Buddha never answered these questions, and I want answers. So he came up to Buddha, and he said, if you'll tell me, is there a soul or not a soul? Is there a beginning to the universe and an end to the universe? And if there's a meaning to life or not a meaning to life, then I'll follow you. And Buddha said, you remind me of a man who was shot with a poisoned arrow, and before he would let a doctor look at him. He wanted to know who shot him, where the man came from, what race he was, what tribe he was from, what his family name was, what kind of arrow it was, what was the shaft made of, what kind of feather was it fletched with, what was the arrowhead made of, what kind of poison it was, who made the poison, and from what direction he was shot from. He said, that man died before he got answers. And he said, I don't waste my time on metaphysical speculation. My teachings deal with stress, the origin of stress, and the cessation of stress. And this is why he didn't answer those questions. He felt that they were not only a waste of time, but also harmful. He felt that argument about metaphysical questions led to evil. He said he thought that these questions that no one could ever really answer were foolish. He thought these were foolish questions. He said that the universe, no one could remember from firsthand experience how the universe came here. He said that once you start speculating about a soul, you begin worrying about the welfare of the soul, and then man-generated metaphysical speculations about religions. And he said that once you do that, there's no end of the evil that arises from the invention of religions. And if you don't believe that, all you have to do is see for yourself. That's what Buddha said, ipasika, come see. That's what his teaching said, ipasika, come see. He said, don't take my word for it. See for yourself. Anything Buddha taught, he said, see for yourself. Don't take my word for it. Don't believe it because I said it, because someone else said it, because you read it in a book, because someone told you. Believe it because, he said, believe it because it's respected by the wise. Believe it because you see for yourself. You test it. You test it. Now, this is called the Charter of Free Inquiry. It doesn't mean believe whatever the hell you want. This means test it and see if it's true. And he gave we'll talk about this sometime. It's called the Kalimas Sutta, because the Kalimas were at this juncture, their village was at this juncture, and every week some new religious guy would come in and say, this is the truth, this is the truth. And then some other guy would come in and go, no, 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 this is the truth. And they said, Prince Gautama, we're confused. Every week somebody comes by and tells us this is the truth. How do we know? And Buddha gave them a set of guidelines to how to test if something is the truth. And he said, don't believe stuff because you read it in a book or because some authority tells you or because and one thing he said was, or because you arrive at it through specious reasoning, through logic. Don't believe it because of that either. Believe it because you test it. And then he went through a series of basically the precepts. You know, he said, if you lie, does that come to good or evil? If you steal, does that come to good or evil? If you sleep with other people's husband or wife, is that good or evil? Does it? You know, what are the results? What happens? And he said, so you know yourself. These things are things you don't do. But the metaphysical questions, and he said these do no good. The ways that they don't tell you about the cause of suffering. They don't tell you how to eliminate the causes of suffering. They don't lead to the liberation of the mind. His teachings were not about that. He didn't care about any of that. He wanted to free the mind. The Buddhist teachings are teachings and techniques to free the mind from the causes and conditions of suffering. So he wasn't going to engage in debate. A lot of people tried to engage him in debates. All through there, people from other religious systems would come and try to engage him in debates, and more often than not, they wound up joining his Sangha. They wound up following him more often than not. So, returning to this, we find that we have descriptions of the mind, which is released from the fuel, the mind like fire unbound. And this is Buddha's attempt to put into words this state that can't be described, but this is his attempt to do so. From one verse, the Digya Nikaya, consciousness without surface, without end, luminous all around, here water, earth, fire, and wind have no footing. Here long and short, coarse and fine, fair and foul, name and form are all brought to an end. With the stopping of sensory consciousness, each here is brought to an end. been from the Udanama. There is monks that dimension where there is neither earth nor water, nor fire nor wind, nor dimension of the infinitude of space, nor dimension of the infinitude of consciousness, nor dimension of nothingness, nor dimension of neither perception nor non-perception, nor this world nor the next world, nor sun nor moon. And there I say there is neither coming nor going nor stasis nor passing away nor arising, without stance, without foundation, without support. This is the end of stress. Where water, earth, fire, and wind have no footing, there the stars do not shine, the sun is not visible, the moon does not appear, darkness is not found. And when a Brahman, a sage through sagacity, has known this for himself, then from form and formless, from pleasure and pain, he is free. And again, consciousness without surface, without end, radiant all around, is not experienced through the solidity of earth, the liquidity of water, the radiance of fire, the windiness of wind, the divinity of devas. Devas were kind of an angelic being. And so on through a list of the various levels of godhood to the allness of the all. Now, let's talk about that, allness of the all. Buddha defined the all, the A-double-A-L-L. he describes the all. All is basically sensory experience. And here he says, what is the all? Simply the eye and forms, ear and sounds, nose and aromas, tongue and flavors, body and tactile sensations, intellect and ideas. This, monks, is termed the all. Anyone who would say, repudiating this all, I will describe another, if questioned on what exactly might be the grounds for his statement, would be unable to explain, and furthermore, would be put to grief. Why? Because it lies beyond range. So, the six senses and their objects, sometimes called the six spheres of contact, constitute the all, and this is always with a capital A. So is there anything beyond the all? Anything beyond sensory experience? So there's many, many conversations about that all throughout. Is there anything beyond sensory experience? Well, that's all we know. We can only explore reality with our senses, and that includes the mind. The mind is a sixth sense. So, that's what Buddha calls the all. Now, here he starts describing non-objectification, nibbana, as it's called in the old text. Monks, that dimension should be experienced where the eye stops and the perception of a form fades. That dimension should be experienced where the ear stops and the perception of sound fades. Where the nose stops and the perception of aroma fades, where the tongue stops and the perception of flavor fades, where the body stops and the perception of tactile sensation fades, where the intellect stops and the perception of idea phenomenon fades, that dimension should be experienced. This experience of this goal, absolutely unlimited freedom, beyond classification, and utterly exclusive of all else, is termed the elemental nibbana property, with no fuel remaining. And it's one of two ways in which nibbana is experienced. And there's a distinction of that. There's nibbana with residue and nibbana with non-residue. So Buddha describes this. Monks, there are two forms of nibbana property, which two, the nibbana property with fuel remaining and the nibbana property with no fuel remaining. And he says, what is nibbana property with fuel remaining? There's the case where a monk is an arahant is an enlightened being, whose effluence have ended, who has attained completion, finished the task, laid down the burden, attained the true goal, destroyed the fetter of becoming, and is released through right gnosis, that's a good word. His five senses, faculties, still remain, and owing to their being intact, he experiences the pleasing and the displeasing, and is sensitive to pleasure and pain. His ending of passion, aversion, and delusion is termed the nibbana property with fuel remaining. And what is the nibbana property with no fuel remaining? There's the case where a monk is an arahant, released through the right gnosis. For him, all that is sensed, being unrelished, will grow cold right there. This is termed the nibbana property with no fuel remaining. And I will tell you that there are monks alive today, and some of them have passed away. A couple I knew of passed away. Ajahn, Ajahn Mun was one, who were monks who were who'd reached Bodhi with effluents remaining. They had residue remaining. there was some controversy about it, about whether they were truly enlightened or not, but I believe they were. And they had experienced the raising. They described the raising of the citta to the Nibbana property, and there were some debate. But I know Ajahn Mun took his disciples. They were both from the Thai forest monk tradition, and they took their disciples and just went to the forest after they discussed it. And the World Buddhist Foundation denounced one of them for publicly speaking about it, and he just said, fine, and he took his monks and went to the forest and didn't talk about it anymore. But I feel that my opinion is that both of them were. They did achieve it. And I'll tell you that I met a monk. There are five levels of enlightenment. The first is called becoming a sotapanna, a stream enterer. And this means you've abandoned self-view. You still have other fetters remaining, and I believe I've met two. And I've discussed this with some other Buddhists, and they usually they're cyber Buddhists who never attended real Buddhist meetings or gone to Buddhist temples or sanghas, and their whole experience with Buddhism is online, and they've argued with me about it. I said, well, how do you know? And I've described my meeting, and they said, well, that could have been something else. That, you know, that could have been this, that could have been that. And I said, well, you know, since you've never actually met a bhikkhu, you never met a monk, you really don't have any grounds to disagree with me. But I think I've met two sotapannas, two monks who were on the first level of enlightenment, so I can tell you that it is attainable. It is attainable. So these are the two versions of Nibbana attainable in the lifetime. And we've been discussing a lot about the idea of calm. There's the other descriptions throughout about the fire being out with ashes, and the fire being out when the embers are still burning, also that way. So there's another one that's a very good one. Ananda, who was Buddha's cousin and also his personal attendant. And the suttas are attributed to Ananda. Ananda remembered the teachings of the Buddha, and the suttas are attributed to him. Ananda once said, in what way, Venerable Sir, might a monk attain concentration of such a form that he would not have neither the perception of earth with regard to earth, nor of water with regard to water, nor fire, wind, etc.? And the Buddha said, there is the case, Ananda, where he would be percipient of this. This is peace. This is exquisite. The resolution of all fabrications, the relinquishing of all acquisitions, the ending of craving, dispassion, stopping. Nibbana. So, Ananda put the same question to Sariputra, who responds that he himself once had experienced such a concentration. And Ananda said, but what were you percipient or aware of at that time? And Sariputra, who was Buddha's number one man, he was second only to the Buddha in attainments, said, the stopping of becoming, Nibbana, the stopping of becoming, Nibbana. One perception arose in me as another perception stopped. Just as in a blazing wood chip fire, one flame arises as another flame stops, even so, the stopping of becoming, Nibbana, the stopping of becoming, Nibbana. One perception arose in me as another one stopped. I was percipient at that time of the stopping of becoming, Nibbana. And I remember reading these things and thinking, oh, I can almost see it. I can almost see it. And when you absorb yourself into these teachings, it is a wonderful thing. And this is going to lead us to our next discussion, which is the 12 links of dependent origination, which we started several weeks ago. The 12 links of dependent origination is the cycle that occurs not only moment by moment, but also it is believed in Buddhism from existence to existence. And it's believed that there's no existing phenomenon that is not the effect of dependent origination. All phenomena arise dependent upon a number of causal factors called conditions. Everything arises from conditions. This is the basic principle of dependent origination. It's very simple. Buddha described it by saying, when there is this, that is. With the arising of this, that arises. When this is not, neither is that. With the cessation of this, that ceases. This is the underpinning of the Four Noble Truths. There is suffering. Suffering is caused by craving. If you eliminate craving, suffering ends. And the Eightfold Noble Path is the way you eliminate craving. So we'll describe the 12 links of discussion in the 3 minutes we have left. We'll go into more detail about them next week. Number one is ignorance. Ignorance means the lack of right understanding. That means that we take ourselves as real. We believe that there's self-nature where there's no self. We find permanence where there's no permanence. And we find beauty where there's no beauty. Mental formations is the next one. Now, these are linked together. Ignorance is the condition for mental formations. And mental formations are the impurities. These are actions of body, speech, and mind. These are mental habits. That gives rise to consciousness. Consciousness are perceiving, comprehending, recognizing, differentiating. These are the six sense consciousnesses. That gives rise to name and form, nama rupa. Name and form are the combination of mind and body. Anything, basically identity and body. That gives rise to the six senses. Eye, ear, nose, touch, mind, etc. The six senses gives rise to contact. Contact is when the six senses contact experience. Eye contacts eye objects, ear contacts ear objects, mind contacts eye objects. Contact gives rise to feelings. Feelings arise from the contact with these objects. It's what you feel when you contact things. Feeling gives rise to craving. Craving is the sensuous desires, the sensual desires, the pursuit of pleasure, identification with the objects. Craving gives rise to clinging. Clinging is the attachment that arises from these objects. Oh, I want that. Oh, I need that. Oh, I have to have that. Clinging gives rise to becoming. Becoming arises from this clinging. Becoming means to give birth, to become, to exist. Because of this attachment to these things, we have this process of being, becoming. And becoming is the condition for birth. And birth arises from becoming. And birth is the condition for old age and death. And old age and death arises out of birth. It's inevitable. And old age and death are the conditions for ignorance. And the cycle goes on and on and on and on and on. And the whole concept of Buddhism, and there are people that like to take this out of it, is to break this cycle, and you can break any one of those changes, any one of those chains, but there are certain key chains, certain key links in that chain. It's very hard. I mean, if you break the six senses, that's not going to help. You know, if you blind yourself and deafen yourself, no. But there are certain key links in that chain that if you break, rebirth ends. That's when you become enlightened. And the big ones are craving and clinging. And ignorance is the big one. Ignorance, craving, clinging, mental formations, karma, and dukkha. Unsatisfactoriness are three words for the same thing. And we're going to get into that next week. So, see you then. And this has been John St. Germain.
You have an appetite for fun? Then the Disney California Adventure Food and Wine Festival is the place to be. March 2nd through April 12th, only at the Disneyland Resort. Enjoy deliciously fresh food, California wines, craft beers, specialty cocktails, live music, and more. All served up with a dash of Disney magic. Get more details at disneyland.com/foodandwine. If you have an appetite for fun, then the Disney California Adventure Food and Wine Festival is the place to be. March 2nd through April 12th, only at the Disneyland Resort. Enjoy deliciously fresh food, California wines, craft beers, specialty cocktails, live music, and more. All served up with a dash of Disney magic. Get more details at disneyland.com/foodandwine.